Welcome. Well, thank you for coming. Welcome to Gathering Requirements, asking the right questions for building a SharePoint 2013 environment. The goal today is to share some of my experiences on interacting with clients, whether they're internal into our organization or if you're a consultant working with external clients. How many people here have seen bad farms built? There's a lot of hands. How many people here have built those bad farms? Oh, not too bad. A couple honest people in here. I mean, I admit, you know, I've put some SharePoint implementations out over the years that they may not have been necessarily bad. They were technically correct, but they were not what the client was expecting, right? Because if you don't ask the right questions or set the right expectations, you're kind of setting yourself up for failure. So that's kind of the gist of what we're going to kind of talk about today is the questions that I believe are important. And there might be more that you want to add to the list or in a couple that you might scratch off. But as I sit down with people and I ask questions, and if I get hit by another train, I go back to my list and I write this question down. Just to let you know, I do have a white paper that is going to cover all of this information that should be available to download. If it's not, I'll have my contact information up too. I'll make sure it gets to Yammer. So the slides, they're going to have the short pieces of the question for me so we can talk about them. But in the documentation, everything is spelled out. So my name is Shannon Bray. I am a Microsoft certified crazy person. So I got on the Microsoft certification bandwagon a long time ago and just never really got off. You can find me on Twitter, noidentity29. And my last recent achievements are, they just released a book on 2013. Chapter 4 in that book is actually on this particular topic, because to me it's a very important topic in order to be able to design good 2013 farm infrastructures. So you are here either because you've done failed implementations, whether you're technically savvy or not, you're new to Microsoft SharePoint 2013, you just want your next project to possibly be successful, and you decided to come in here and see if I might be able to give you a glimmer of hope. Or you just want the questions that I am going to give away. So either one, this will probably cover just about everybody. Maybe somebody in here picked the wrong room and just is too lazy to get up and walk out right now. So that'll be bullet number 5, I guess. So the importance of gathering requirements. I mean, these are all obvious, right? We all have goals in life, and as we set goals, we all make steps to accomplish those goals. But it seems like when we start talking about SharePoint and we have a goal, oftentimes our goals are just like, yeah, I want to put SharePoint up. Well, you're kind of selling yourself short by not really thinking through the business processes. So typically, the more detailed your plans are to be successful in your goals, the more success your project's going to have. And SharePoint's really no different. I've done farm builds for clients that they call up and say, I want 2013. And I start trying to go through my list, and they're like, no, I just want you to build me a farm. I want to go in it, and I want to play with it. I'm like, okay, so that is in itself its own set of requirements, right? They're trying to evaluate SharePoint. They hear about how great it is with all the features and Yammer and all of this stuff, and they want to see if it can apply to their organization. And on the flip side, you have these people who are just, they have this big, massive dream of SharePoint, and have never even seen it. But SharePoint has to fit in that dream. The problem is, you know, SharePoint can solve about 80% of our business requirements, but it's really tough to get some of those other 20% sometimes. So I have this client on SharePoint 2010, SQL Server 2012, and, you know, I didn't build the farm personally, so they had some minor issues. But overall, it was okay. And they they're built to the minimum specs of SharePoint 2010. Now, you know, when 2013 first came out, they were pretty much saying it'll be about the same hardware, but after it was battle tested a little bit, we all kind of found out that the specs jumped at least 50%. And even those numbers may be a little small because these are the absolute minimum requirements. So when we're taking a look at a client such as this, who is a fairly robust farm, everything is high availability, disaster recovery built in. But now they're looking to go to 2013. What questions do I have to ask them to get them to their end game? And we'll kind of talk about them a little bit as we go through. So who can tell me what they think the most important question to ask is? Anybody want to throw themselves out there? What do you intend to do with it? That's a pretty good question. That's up there. It's not quite my yes. What's the risk? That's a very good one. Cash. It always comes down to cash. How much money do you have? I can give you the world. So the problem space in that we have to deal with is, the first one's the big one. People ignore the minimum requirements. And I'm convinced that people have never even read the minimum requirements. They get their disk. They're running over to the server, they stick it in, and they're just expecting greatness to happen. Some people, they knew 2010 very well, and they're just assuming that 2013 is going to follow the same methodology. And as we know, with the way the Office web apps are now off and our workflows are now off, there's a little bit more complexity there. You might even have your own server for your distributed cache, so we'll talk about that a little bit too. Lack of planning is really the big one. You know, I want SharePoint, I want it now, and I want it done next week, and I want it done in, 5 hours or less. Failure to manage expectations is probably the biggest one that I've been guilty of, over the last couple years, is just because I feel like I knew SharePoint so well, and I've not gone back and really understood what somebody's expectations were. I hear their requirements, but coming into SharePoint as a developer, any developers in here? A few, right? We're found guilty of that all the time, where we gather requirements as a developer, and we code the slickest solution known to man, and we drop it off to the people who ask, and they're like, what is this? This is the best solution you've ever seen. And it misses the mark just because it's technically correct. But the way you think and the way they think and things like that don't always end and meet in the middle. So it's always about expectations. And then the final one is not really knowing the boundaries of SharePoint. If you're trying to do something in SharePoint and you've completely exceeded the boundaries and it's starting to fail as a service, we'll struggle there as well. So, typical thing, if the client is off envisioning something like this, and when you leave, they have this, they may not be happy, no matter what you've done on the back end, right? It could be 2012, full high availability, disaster recovery, and you could just have your stamp of approval on it, and it's all about what it looks like, right? Because everybody wants SharePoint. But nobody ever wants SharePoint to look like SharePoint. Even when when 2013 came out, how many people said, wow, that's a new look. I can dig that. Anyone? Oh, no hands, right? So as you can see, how it looks is equally as important. And this is where the expectations come through. So in my opinion, there's four phases of a successful project. You have the discover and refining the requirements, which is basically what we're going to do here today. And then once you have those requirements, then you sit down with the stakeholders, and then you start analyzing and prioritizing the requirements, because some of them are going to cost more than others. And we'll kind of talk about HADR and stuff here in a little bit. And then you have to design the solution that actually meets those requirements, and that's where we're starting to really get the rubber to the road, and making sure that the client is going to be happy. And then after that, and a lot of times this is where I fall out, because they have their own SharePoint team or whatever. And then they govern the solution, the operation, the maintenance, or they say that they're going to do it, and then they call you a year later, the event, you know, the event logs are full of errors, and they've ran out of, the reason why they called you is because SharePoint shut down because it ran out of space, right? And they're hitting their favorite search engine, trying to figure out what this error is, and when you let SharePoint go to that critical mass, there's those errors don't even match what really happened. It doesn't say you ran out of disk space. It says, I don't know, some ugly error. All right, so in this discussion, and we're not going to talk about minimum requirements, like I'm not going to go through and say this is a minimum requirement. There's a couple I'm going to point out just because they're not as obvious. But it's important that we all understand where to find them. And when I do my demo, I'll pull them up and highlight a couple, but it's really kind of tough to demo gathering requirements unless I'm like, hey, what do you think, what's your goal for this project? And I write it down. You know, that's not that exciting. But we want to make sure that we plan for success, plan for governance, plan for information architecture, business processes, security requirements, BI, the office client, performance reliability, and then business continuity. So I have a set of questions that go to each one of these buckets that allow me to at least make sure I'm trying to ask the right questions. You know, every once in a while something might slip by, but this is an overall pretty good bucket in my opinion. So here's the big thing, and this is confusing to a lot of people, or it seems to be confusing because people aren't getting it. So here's the minimum requirements, and this is exactly the way it reads on TechNet. But what I find is when I go in into an implementation, and they may only have 4 gigs of RAM, 8 gigs of RAM, some of them will have 12 gigs of RAM on a box, but then they have everything installed on this box, right? They have SQL, they have all the services running, and they're not meeting their minimum requirements. It's important to know that your web servers and your app servers must have a minimum of 12 gigs of RAM, and you can't expect them to be running the full load. If you're going to be doing the full load, they're going to need at least 24 gigs of RAM. But 12 with multiple 3-tier server farms is really kind of what we want to go. Now, a lot of us, how many people in your daily job are SharePoint architects and you design SharePoint solutions? All right, so for all those hands that just came up, in your mind, you typically have probably a blueprint that you start with, and then you might ask questions, or you may not. You may just say, you know, every time I build a farm, this is what I do, and this is why I do it. And there's nothing wrong with that approach either, as long as the client understands where you're coming from. Some of the other minimum requirements is, you know, we understand SQL Server, 64-bit, 48 cores, 8 gigs for small deployments, at least 16 gigs for larger ones. I like 24, 32, you know, SQL's our back end. We've got to make sure we take care of it. Now, here's where we're kind of going off the reservation a little bit on the minimum requirements, because some things that have become incredibly popular lately is the geo-clustered farms or the stretch farms, you know, where people want high availability, but they want their web servers in Dallas, their SQL servers in Denver, and they try to do that to alleviate, you know, national disasters or anything like that. And the problem is while SharePoint is supported in a stretch farm scenario, it has to be less than 1 millisecond of latency to and then from the SQL server and the web front end servers, which basically means if a server's over here, the SQL server can be in the corner of the room, right? It's not that far. Some people have been able to do with that dark fiber or whatever, you know, you get across the street or something like that, but we're not talking about states. So it's important to know that, so when you're gathering requirements and people start setting those expectations, that is not something that is going to happen. Now, there's ways to get around that, but you end up moving your whole, you have like a DNS switch that moves your entire farm, and you don't have the distance between your web servers and your SQL servers. And finally, this is a quote right out of TechNet talking about distributed cache. How many people use VMware or Hyper-V to support your implementations? Now, out of those hands, how many people are using that shared memory over allocation or something similar to that? A couple. So SharePoint is not supported in those scenarios, right? Because the distributed cache does not know how to handle that. The reason why I bring that up is because as a person who's asking the requirement or trying to set expectations, this is the one that's kind of leaked through a few times where I'm taking all of the answers down, but then we get to the end and then I find out they've completely over-allocated to give me my 12 or 24 gigs and they don't have any more RAM to give me, and it's SharePoint's unstable because of the distributed cache and things like that. So it is important to know that you have to have static memory in those scenarios. All right, planning for success. This is where we start really getting into the actual questions that are going to lead us down the yellow brick road. So this is one of my newer questions too, that first one is why SharePoint 2013? Because 2010 did a lot of things very well. You know, 2013 has the same core infrastructure as 2010, but it does have a lot of cool features in the social space and in some of its cross-site collections and things like that. But those features aren't very well known to a lot of people who are just asking for SharePoint. So I just try to find out what was their selling point on why they're moving there. Did they see the Ferrari website and go, yeah, that's SharePoint, I want that? Or is it actually the capabilities of enterprise search? The key players are always important. And you kind of want to always talk to as many of them as possible. The problem with the key players is they don't always agree, especially if you put them in a one-on-one situation. You start asking them what they would like to have, what their goals for the implementation are. What they would expect out of a successful implementation. And then as you start talking to a couple other people, you start finding out that some of these may actually have conflicting goals. You want to find out what the reporting relationships are between these stakeholders, right? Find out who the big cheese really is. And then also when it really comes down to who's going to actually pay the bill, because ultimately that's the guy who's got the most say. But it is nice to ask all of who the key players are, because you can have the best farm out there, you can meet all their expectations, but if people didn't feel like they had buy-in, they're not going to jump on board. That's also going to come down to training that we'll talk about here shortly too. You kind of want to know why each stakeholder is involved, but more importantly, what their business objectives are. What are they going to get out of SharePoint? Some people have no idea. They're just going to SharePoint because the IT department deployed it, right? And while SharePoint may have been successfully deployed in that environment, it may not be a successful tool going down the road. The vision statements is important too. If you actually ask somebody, hey, what's your vision statement for not only SharePoint, but for your company, they kind of open up a little bit more, because now they kind of feel like you're trying to at least understand who they are, what they do. You might even care a little bit. I've talked to some people that, you know, they spent 2-3 weeks at somebody's office deploying SharePoint, and you ask them a question, oh, it's great, well, what does that company do? And they're like, I don't know. Well, then you've missed the boat on actually getting to know who those people are. And then there's a pretty good chance that you may not have mapped their business objectives to their initiatives and things like that, because you didn't ask those questions. Conflicting goals. The one that kind of comes off, you know, those don't happen very much, but sometimes technology is conflicting. SharePoint 2013 is claims mode. Right? In order to get Classic, you have to use PowerShell. But there's some BI scenarios that require Classic mode. So if you're doing some hardcore BI stuff, you may not be able to do the server-to-server auth in the same, you know, solution, so you may have to do some other things. So it'll be important to be able to identify those scenarios as well. So as you're asking the questions, these people have to be fairly technical a little bit, but if you kind of gone down the minimum requirements and some of the other things that we'll talk about, you're probably stronger than most. Parameters of a successful project. This is actually on my next slide because that to me is the number one question. What will make this project successful to you? And then I get that and I write it down, I have them sign it, and that's what I strive for. Steps to maximize and measure user adoption. How many people have built a farm and nobody uses it because nobody knows how to use SharePoint? Quite a few, right? How many people actually ask if they have a training budget after you build a farm? Okay, quite a few hands. So that's probably the most important thing too is, you know, it doesn't matter where they get the training, whether it's a DVD, they come to the SharePoint conference, they watch the videos online. I mean, they have to have something, and it's not necessarily even a budget. A lot of stuff is free, right? The SharePoint community is outstanding in trying to share information. People just have to kind of know where to go look at it. But the problem is the people who are the end users who might only be doing it a couple times aren't really going to dedicate their weekend to learning SharePoint, right? You guys are a little different because most of you like SharePoint. The other half just really likes to come to Vegas. And then plans for maintenance and monitoring. That's important because you always, you buy a car, you bring it, go get an oil change. If you don't do that, you expect your car to blow up. Same thing with SharePoint. So, planning success. What will determine the success of the project? If you don't know the answer to this question before you start, you are not planning for success. So you have to get some sort of specifics about it, whether it is a reduction in time and cost, specific ROIs, something that you can measure. It can't just be just this gray cloud the guy's thinking, because you'll never be able to hit the target. We have scope creep that hits us all the time for those of us who are professional consultants, right? You get halfway down, somebody changes their mind, and then it gets very tough to keep a positive relationship as you're going through the process. Now, if you have a list of, I don't know, 100 questions, and they've answered the questions, or you've answered the questions, they reviewed them, and you've signed them, it's kind of like a contract, right, of saying, this is what you said you need, this is what I'm building for you. You can change your mind, but let's at least get this taken care of, call it success, and let's move to another one and capture that. The most important thing is everything should be measurable. Governance strategies. Governance is a big word. It's a big nasty word in some places, right? A lot of people have governance teams, but they have no idea why certain people are on them. I had this engagement that had, it was for a law firm. They had over 30 attorneys in there, and they were all on the governance board. They all disagreed. So you kind of want to have the key players in the room, like your IT people, your information architecture people, or people from the library sciences, and people who actually care about how the information comes through, not necessarily lawyers. You might need one or two lawyers, you know, for information. Yes, sir. That's a great question. Yes, his question was, how do you encourage management to let them know that they need to have a governance team? Yes. Failure is basically their option if they don't get on board. That's the only thing that's going to happen. That's a tough question. Yeah, well, you know, because SharePoint has it's the slippery soap rule, basically, right? If you squeeze too tight, you lose grip. If you don't hold it tight enough, you let it go. I've seen places where there was no governance, and you know, the Wild West happens, and it's complete failure. But then you also have the other ones that the site collection administrator is the same as the farm administrator, and nobody has permissions to do anything. So I guess it's just more of a candid conversation, I think. I would basically try to pull him off the side and ask him who he wants to be on his governance team, and instead of trying to convince him that he should have one. It's kind of like the, if you ask a question that the answer has to be yes, then it might work. I don't really get a whole bunch of pushback now on that, but I used to. You know, probably beginning life cycle of 2010, a lot of people were just like, well, we don't need to do that. We got it covered. So that's fantastic. All right, yeah, so the members of the governance board, the vision statement of the project. You know, if a project, if they care enough about a project, they should have a vision statement for it, is really what it comes down to. Define the roles and responsibilities. And see, even that might determine the governance board without them specifically. I got one guy, he didn't want to name names because he didn't want to leave other people out and stuff like that. I don't know how you become president of a company and still be that nice, but it happens. But when you leave that engagement, or if you work for that company, by the time you're moving on to another project, you should have a list of names. Like Tom, he's going to take care of our backups. He is going to do all our maintenance and monitoring. He's going to test his backups once a week, once a month, or whatever. Becky, she's in charge of content, right? So she's the one that actually gets to approve everything. And if you set these roles up, everybody kind of knows what their jobs are. And that's something, by the way, that I like to get written down for two reasons. That way when they call up and they say, hey, something's not working, I'll be like, oh, well, Tom was supposed to be doing that. And they're like, oh, yeah, Tom left 6 months ago. Kind of lets you know where things are. Policies and standards, right? You kind of want to have a general conversation around content, you know, content approval, how it gets there, all the parameters around that. Design, this is going to kind of go back to that first opening slide, what they want it to look like. Security is a big thing, right? Because we have our claim space. We can have our users in Active Directory. They could be an ADFS off of some third-party implementation. Are we going to manage all of the users ourselves, or are we going to let the host company manage that? So if you work for like a security agency that worked with several law enforcement, right, you don't want to have all of the police officers in your AD. You would rather have an ADFS implementation and let them manage it. And primarily because if somebody leaves one of those other agencies, you may not get the update. Right, so they still have access to your systems and things like that, and now there's no security. So that's important. So security always comes down to many, many questions that I'm going to highlight here in a minute. What features do they want to use in SharePoint? How are they going to be managed? Are they enterprise features, standard features? Navigation's always a big one, because everybody wants the big global navigation, but they always want their own site collections and things like that. Custom code is probably the big one now. How many people are on Office 365? Oh, I expected to see a couple more hands than that. But we have our limitations, right? We're not able to use custom code there, but now we have our hybrid solutions and stuff like that that allow us to get there. And it's important that people understand that while we're gathering their requirements, because they can't just come in at the last minute and say, oh yeah, by the way, I need to get this, and you're like, whoa, that's a game changer. HIPAA, right? Anybody seen the HIPAA button in SharePoint? If you don't have the conversation around content and HIPAA compliances and things like that, and somebody comes up to you at the end and go, hey, is it HIPAA compliant? You're like, are you kidding me? No, it's not HIPAA compliant. Where's your lawyer? Where's, you know, what do we have to do with? Because every time I've heard of the HIPAA rules, they're always different, right? So if you don't ask those questions, then you kind of get stuck in. By the way, HIPAA is one of my questions. Does this have to be HIPAA compliant? And they're like, we're a gas station. Just look, I'm just asking. And then your composite applications, you know, they're, that's our InfoPath, SharePoint Designer, and things like that. Are they going to be used in the environment? How are you going to use them? What are you going to use after InfoPath goes away? Things like that. And then branding. You know, branding in 2013 is just amazing now. All right, so let's actually get into the questions. The information architecture. What type of sites and how are you going to access them? Does it use NTLM? Does it need to use Kerberos? Are you going to be interacting with data on the back end? If you're going to be using data on the back end, are you going to use BCS, Secure Store? They may not know all of those, but in your mind, you have to start thinking about how this solution is going to play out. Content types, site columns, who's going to be in charge of this? And do you even know what they are? A lot of my very first demos are on content types and site columns, and then a lot of my second and third demos are on the same thing because people don't get them. If they're new to SharePoint, you're like, yeah, this is a site column. You're able to see it through the entire site, right? But then we have a content type. It uses site columns. And when you start explaining how it works in a document, it's tough. So you have to have a pretty solid demo on how to create them, how to use them, how to manage them, and it becomes more of a complex solution. Content security, we kind of talked about it a little bit. One of the things that people fail to understand, and it's not necessarily a requirement in SharePoint, it just makes it work better, is that as you go down your site collection, you can restrict security just fine. But I've seen a lot of people, you know, they'll restrict the top level site, but they want Jim to have access to a site three levels down. And while it works, it doesn't give them a good breadcrumb trail and things like that. So it's important that they kind of understand to kind of scale things down as these sites go down. User experience is going to be key. Some people pick up SharePoint better than others. If you're with an organization and they're not very technically savvy, it's tough to be successful without proper training. Document storage is big, right? Because everybody's heard about all the conflicting posts out there, right? Do I use remote blob storage? Do I not use remote blob storage? What are the benefits? Are they really benefits? Are you really saving me money? Or are you just taking my money now for a backup solution? And things like that. A lot of people, you know, they get on the, oh, RBS is going to save me money. But then in the end, they find that it doesn't actually save them anything. Document metadata. Absolutely important, right? Because if we don't metadata our documents and we're trying to use enterprise search, we don't really get all the capabilities that we should. Now, there's a couple tricks that I try to do to kind of auto-populate metadata on documents using some of the features inside SharePoint, and that kind of alleviates a little bit. I use folder structures to kind of trick people into using the metadata. But it's still difficult because people will upload a document, but then they won't add all the metadata to it that they could. Then you make it required, and then they stop uploading documents. Document storage before SharePoint, what were they using? Most people are just using file systems. So, or the file stream, so then they just want to copy their junk out and they want to move it right into SharePoint and they expect all of this wonderful magic to happen. But that's probably more of an expectation thing. I try to tell people that it's a slow process of migration where they should do it manually, in my opinion. But there's tools out there that people like to use, and they just do like this big mass import. And some people have been successful with it, and they like what they've gotten. Others, you know, you don't get what you pay for. It's you get the effort that you put into it. So if you set it up just to push a button and go, you're not going to be that successful. But if they use those tools and they really map things out, then it's much better. Document management policies. what are the document management policies you're going to have for a particular list or for a particular library? Are they going to be able to print inside the office and still be able to print at home? Some organizations, if you work for like a government agency, you can do whatever you want inside the building. You can't remove classified information. You might be able to access some of the sites offsite, but you're no longer able to print or anything like that. So it's important to understand those, because those policies actually get set up when in the security. You can set what zones have what particular policies. Those aren't necessarily difficult to change after the fact, but they're very important to kind of know beforehand. It might even determine on whether or not you have a single web application versus multiple ones. And manage terms and keywords. A lot of people, if you ask, what are your managed terms and keywords, they're not going to really know. So you have to sit down with them, look at their documents, try to really understand some of their business processes, and then you come up with those managed terms and things like that. Planning success. Probably the number one rule is implementing a tool should not dictate the process, right? You don't install SharePoint and do it the SharePoint way and expect your business to thrive. Right? You have your business way, and SharePoint should try to fit those needs as close as possible, and then we work it out to get the rest of them in there. So the tools that are selected to enable a process should not dictate the requirements. It's important to remember that the requirements first and the technology should come second. You may get down, you're asking all these questions, and you go, you know what? SharePoint's not the tool for you. And you know what? That's okay. Microsoft would rather you have them use a tool that's going to be successful instead of them going, man, it's SharePoint. It's garbage, right? I hate it. It's the worst thing we ever did. Business processes. Business processes are funny because when you actually ask somebody what their business processes are, a lot of people seem to struggle with that. Can you define your workflow for me? Or what do you mean? Well, what do you do on a daily basis? Or, you know, if we're trying to dictate a process. A lot of people don't even think about what their processes are until you ask them those questions. And then they tell you something, and then the next day, they'll be like, oh, you know what? I forgot this happens, or I forgot that happens. Or you go talk to somebody else, and the process seems to be completely different. So it's nice if you ask them about their business processes, and then if you have a team of people, you can get buy-in on those processes. Because then if you're using SharePoint Designer, Visual Studio, one of these other third-party workflow engines to create business processes, but the workflow doesn't really work the way the company does, then it may not be successful. Now, on the flip side of that, I've seen times where those tools have made their processes better because now their processes actually have to follow rules instead of things just kind of happening sometimes. Types of browsers or policies around content, you know, that's kind of getting back to the security and things like that, what we've talked about. Types of browsers is big. It was more, I think, more important in 2010 with like InfoPath and things like that. Some of the tool sets didn't work as well as they work now in 2013. But when you're installing SharePoint 2013 into an organization and everybody has an iPad, you're probably you're going to have an uphill battle. You've done that. Yes. Yeah, there's some gotchas. So you have to be able to lay that out. Now, some of the organizations I've worked with, they're like, well, that's okay. We're going to use IE. And so they have IE versions for, you know, the Apples and things like that. But most of the people who have those, they don't want to use IE. So they want to use their Safari browsers. Who's responsible for defining the process? This is kind of a governance question and stuff too, but who's got the overall say-so? So once you get all of this, you kind of want to get the stamp from whoever's going to own that process. And it's okay for them to change their mind too, because the workflows are fairly easy to change, right? Designer is just basically a wizard. You enter an action, You set the result. Composite applications, what composite applications will be available? Most of the, you know, SharePoint Designer is free. That's always there. InfoPath is still heavily used in a lot of people I interact with. In fact, I have a whole InfoPath team. That's all I do is the InfoPath forms. And in a line of business data, that's one of the coolest things with SharePoint, being able to interact with data in their accounting packages or whatever, bring it in so it looks like it belongs in SharePoint. They're able to interact with it that way, but then it actually lives in the back. Security and stuff can be done that way too, because you might be using SharePoint to manipulate the user store, and then you're using ADFS or something like that to modify that. So if you've identified those beforehand, that might completely change the way your architecture is going to come out too. Security requirements, the who, when, what, why, and how. Internal, external, same rights, authentication, PII, here's all the nasty ones. With the ability, you know, SharePoint 2013 has given us some pretty cool sharing features, right? But you might have realized that some of those email addresses aren't so shareable, right? It has to be like Outlook or Hotmail. They have to be within the Microsoft domain, or you have to set them up differently. Maybe you set those user up as forms-based authentication, things like that. If they're with another agency, are you using ADFS? The ADFS, is that other organization going to use ADFS? If they're not, are you prepared to bring everybody and stick them in your Active Directory? If you're going to put everybody in your Active Directory, are you going to use Active Directory groups, or are you going to use SharePoint groups? And what's the difference between those? These questions here typically take a good chunk of time to kind of go through. Authentication, you know, with your NTLM, your Kerberos, anything that you have there, it's important that they understand how all of that works. PII, nobody wants it in there, but everybody seems to have it. You know, you can find it at your nearest bar stool that somebody in some government agency left their laptop sitting there with all of our information on it. So do you have PII in your system? Who has access to it? Can everybody see it? Is it printable? What do you consider PII? You know, typically, if it's a name and phone number, it's in the phone book, so that's not PII. But everything else about you can be considered there. You know, social security numbers and addresses are well known, but it could even be a picture of you or something like that that compromises who you are as a person. Ports, gateways, proxies, load balancers. All important to know what people are planning on doing beforehand. Load balancers are, you have the free one, right, NLB. Not really a load balancer, but it's more of a round robin, sends a request. But that doesn't actually do any sort of health checking. So if people are really looking for load balancing, they might be looking for one of those higher end solutions. Ports are a big one. They like to shut down everything. A lot of people, I do a lot of work with the federal government, and it's basically like if it's not port, you know, 143 or 80, it's shut down. Problem is our service applications like to talk over 328.43, 44, 45. We've got our Kerberos talking over different ports. So when we shut down all these ports, SharePoint stops working. So it's good to map out the ones that are needed. And then so that they understand which ones they have to keep open. Antivirus is important. Are you going to scan documents before it gets in, out? You're going to run it through. Some antiviruses that are made for SharePoint really aren't made for SharePoint. So that's kind of important. How server hardening, what are you actually going to do to try to lock down your servers? I mean, a lot of people, and GPO settings will come up here in a minute too. Probably my biggest crutch is GPO settings, because nobody has them until you find out about them, and then nobody knows, you know, how to update it or something like that. You always get this one little weird rule that's going to mess up your service pack. We just had one the other day, and it was like, "Do you have any GPO settings?" Well, no, but we've turned all of that off. this week.
Really?
Yeah. So those are kind of important to know. Predefined network topologies. Some of the topologies aren't supported for SharePoint, but in some topologies are dictated by people who sell hardware, right? So they may want you to have all these different configurations that are redundant and not necessarily be as beneficial to your company, but some security expert wrote about it, so it must be so. Rights management, who's gonna have access to it? Compliance and auditing, anybody have to use all the auditing features in SharePoint? Nope. Anybody ever played with the auditing features in SharePoint? They're not bad. I mean, they're probably not to the extreme that people who are actually using auditing features need them to be, but they're, if used right, they offer some capabilities. Password policies are a big one. Everybody's got to change their password every other day, right? So SharePoint has the ability for us to set when our passwords change for our managed accounts. I don't really know if that's the best feature in the world, because once it changes it, nobody really knows the password, so that's fairly secure. but passwords seem to always be the one thing that comes up and bites people. 2007 was notorious. You change a password, you're done, right? You then had to go off and read 20 different blog posts, and only two of them were correct on password changes. With the way that the passwords work now in 2010, 2013, you know, it operates better. You're able to transition with those a little better. GPL settings, we just talked about. But then the groups in AD and SharePoint, that's always a pretty big conversation as well, just because, you know, most of our infrastructures are in AD. We might have one-offs that we need to put into SharePoint. But then who's actually owning the control of those sites? You know, it's not necessarily the site owners if it's the people who are actively doing the Active Directory. And the people who are doing Active Directory probably don't want to be updating all these groups every week just because Sally decided to go create a new site. So it's a good conversation, and I like to use both. I like to use primarily AD and then SharePoint groups as a smaller subset. Guess I never started my clock, so. Business intelligence, reports, charts, dashboards, scorecards, KPIs, everybody loves the BI, right? It gives us that visual indication on how things are going. So you have like your CEO walks in and he's like, yep, everything's green. I'm gonna go play golf today. If it's yellow, then he's like, let's have a meeting about having a meeting and figuring out how we're gonna get this to not be yellow. And if it's red, he's just going to start firing people until it turns green. So KPIs are pretty important. Also, in addition with those, I mean, some of these are extremely expensive. They straight up change your architecture. If you find out that they need Excel services and Performance Point at the end of the implementation, you're in trouble, right? Because you may need an entire server for that. You may not. It may be able to just operate off the your web roles. But that's the conversation you need to have. If they're heavily on Excel services and you didn't plan for it, and now you're asking for three more servers, you're gonna have an upset person, especially when they already had the conversation about being over cached or over allocated on the RAM that they just gave you, and now you're asking for like 36 gigs of RAM per server. Depending on what you need, that's bad. The role of the Office client. Office is growing up, right? It works very well in the web browsers. You're able to use this technology across the web, but you have to really kind of know what features you need out of it. And here's some of the cool ones that I really like. You have the, are you gonna cache the document locally? With 2013, right now they're just moving back just the differentials and stuff. So it really kind of helps on some of the latency environments that we may have. Co-authoring is cool. I still love seeing that work. You know, when you're sitting there working on a document, you have another teammate working on it, and he's working on the paragraph right underneath you, and it just starts changing. That's when you know you're in a world that seems to be getting productive. Mobile applications. Mobile's big. Right. So do you need to look at SharePoint on a mobile device? What is that mobile device? Is it a BlackBerry or is it a Windows phone? You know, some browsers are better than others, and they're not always the ones that you expect them to be. And then OneDrive or OneDrive Pro. So OneDrive and OneDrive Pro, names are very similar. Two different offerings. So it's important to kind of understand the differences there and that people know that it's available to them to use so that they can put their documents up in the cloud or they can use the My Site features inside SharePoint. Planning success. Don't ignore SharePoint Online as an option if it fits, right? You don't want to just push everybody to the cloud. But at the same time, if they have a very small IT department and they can benefit from having their Exchange, their SharePoint, and all of that managed somewhere else, and then if they have some complexity, then maybe they can go to the hybrid environment or some of that if they have a very high BI load. So it's at least important to have the conversation. Whether or not it's a good fit or not is a completely different story. Business continuity, here's the big one. Because everybody wants their business to continue even if something happens. So it's important to talk about any defined SLAs. A lot of companies don't have them. Some people are, even internally though, they'll have SLAs with other internal organizations inside their company. Some SLAs are like, it just has to start working within 48 hours. Well, that's pretty easy to do. But then what's their expected RPO and RTO? I have a slide coming up in a second that'll define those. But that's basically how much data can you lose and how much time does it take me to get it back up? Who's responsible for those backups? Have they tested the backups? I've seen some people spend some crazy amount of money on a backup solutions. And then when you ask them, hey, did you test it? They're like, what? Well, how do you know that's going to work? Well, they don't. A lot of people, you find out about that situation when it fails, and then they're trying to, they call you up, and they want to know what special kung fu you know to bring back their data. And it doesn't exist, right? You lose your data, we're done. Who's responsible for the DR plan? That's going to be a big one. And you know what? It could be me. You can say, you know what? I don't want to be responsible for it. You do it for me. Then we're on the same page at least, because then I'll be like, all right, once a week I'll come in, I'll test your backups, I'll make sure they work. Then you'll at least be, you're okay. How often is the plan tested? It should be kind of tested. Every day you should make sure that you at least had a backup, right? You should probably test it once a week, and then you should do a full recovery, like once a month, just to make sure that your plan works. Location of data centers is important, right? Just start talking about the geolocations and things like that. Wherever your data centers need to be, so does your app and your web servers. And then budget, right? That's the big one. Because when you ask a CEO or FTO or CFO or anybody like that, you'd be like, how much data can you lose? And he'll be like, oh, that's easy. None. I'm not going to lose any data. Great. How much time do I have to get that back up? And he's like, right now. That's what I want. No data, right now. So then you say, okay, I can work with that. And then you bring him back a price tag of millions of dollars, right? And he's like, oh, what? Maybe I can lose a little bit of data. So I think I'm pretty good with losing about 5 minutes and it taking an hour for it to come back up. Well, then that's something I can work with. So now we have an RTO and an RPO that is specified, And now we can offer a solution for it, because now it may be database mirroring, or it could be always on, or some other solution like that. The one thing that trips me up, and if somebody here can explain it to me after the session, I'm more than ready to understand this technology. But when I go in and I talk about what is your high availability disaster recovery plan, they're like, got it covered. And I'm like, well, you just asked me to build one server here. What happens if it goes down? No, we have an ESX cluster. It's got like some special feature on it that it starts building everything over. We're highly available. I'm like, well, does it go down? He goes, yeah, for about 5 minutes. I'm like, A, you're not highly available because you're offline. He doesn't get that, and I've had this conversation a few times with people. But I get the DR part. Last week, actually, I was building this farm, same conversation. I'm like, oh, you know what? I'm tired of having the same conversation. I was like, this is awesome. I've been looking for somebody to where I can build a limited farm on, and then we can just start unplugging stuff, and we can see how it works. And he's like, I'll be happy to show you. So we're in the middle of the install, and apparently his main server that controls all of this crashed. So then all of the servers we were doing the installs on dumped. So now I was like, where's your high availability and disaster recovery now? So we ended up actually building out a 6-server farm for him. But there's an ESX cluster genius back here. So if you know what technology they're talking about, whatever, I'd love to kind of hear how, because I know how it tries to transfer stuff over and there's a switch, but that's not high available. You know, it is, I think that there's a loss in terms. And that to me is a harder conversation than the governance board, right? Because I'm just a SharePoint guy. I don't know anything about high availability, is basically what they tell me. Performance and reliability. This is one of my very favorite interview questions if I'm interviewing a candidate to come on to my SharePoint team. It'll be, what are some of the questions that you ask when building a farm? And typically, I always hear the, how many users in the organization? And so I think about it a little bit. I'm like, that's a pretty good question. But what if they have 5,000 people in an organization and 4,000 of them are bus drivers and 500 of them are teachers somewhere and only 5 people use SharePoint? Like, oh, you built a pretty massive farm that nobody's actually going to use. So it all comes down to concurrent users. And there's some people out there who've kind of, they're well-read, and they'll be like, it's about the number of concurrent users you have. And then I'm like, oh, very good. Define concurrent. And they're like, what? So just so that we're all on the same page, concurrent is the number of users who access your site within a given minute. So when we're looking for performance and reliability, that's what we're looking for, to see, did you have 50,000 users hit your site within 1 minute, or was it 5 users? Because that's how we build a reliable farm infrastructure. How fast do you expect to grow over the next couple years? It might be 3, 5, or whatever. Whatever they're going to give you, it's probably going to be a little smaller, right? Because that's when you go back to the training budget and user adoption and all of that. They see them here. They didn't spend the money for those, so their growth is going to be a little slower. And by the way, growth isn't just, we're going to take our file system and dump it into SharePoint and look how big it grew. That is a failure of growth. Performance metrics. So out of who's my super farm builders out there? I know there's a couple out there that are proud, and nobody's going to raise their hand. Oh. Out of those people who didn't raise their hand, how many people, let me ask the question a little different, how many people have used Visual Studio to load test your farms after you're done? A couple. So what you want to do now is, after we've had this conversation and they're on the same page saying, hey, this is starting to look successful, then we can then take their concurrent users, we can load test with Visual Studio against it, and then say, hey, you know what, Sam? We can hit your site with 500 concurrent users. I can go and I can unplug a SQL server. Always on availability, keeps us up and running. We don't go down. And you know what? You're going to start to see a hiccup around 700. And they're like, you know what? We'll never have 700 people, so I'm good. You know, that's a good conversation to have. Or he might be like, ooh, you know what? Over the next 3 years, I plan on having 1,000 people. And I'll be like, all right, well then, you know, next year, let's revisit on how we're going to get a little bit more bang for your buck. Maybe we're adding some servers or things like that. What services are we going to use inside SharePoint? So SharePoint has a lot of cool services, many of which most of us don't need to use all of them. But a lot of the farms that I actually have to come in and fix, they were built using the farm configuration wizard. Right? And somebody was like, check, 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 check. And when you go in there, the servers are already under RAMed, right? And they got way too many app pools that are actually outside the supportable range. And I'll talk about that here in a second. But it's because, and there's no need for that. They're not actually using those services. Geographical areas, where your server's going to operate in, that's come up a few times, but it's important to kind of know. 80 SharePoint SQL locations, make sure that they're all in the same peak hours. Is it 9 to 5? Are you international? Are you 24 hours a day? What are we going to measure? What logs do we have to look at during your peak days to make sure that everything is working the way it should? Monitoring and maintaining. I have a white paper that if anybody's interested on that, I can share as well. But you should have a set of tasks. This is done daily. It's done weekly. This is done monthly. And it doesn't fail. That's how we maintain SharePoint. So they have to have somebody who you hold their feet to the fire on those. Expected load kind of goes with the peak hours and stuff. But the RAM, the distribution of that RAM, and Enuma boundaries. I mean, we might take 16 gig sticks, but if we're starting to break them all up or have 4 gigs of RAM from one stick, 4 from another, we're not going to have as much performance as we want. This typically all ends up in that ESX conversation that we're having with over allocation, and they don't need high availability and disaster recovery. So very difficult conversations to have. Network speed, most networks are good, but you know, if you're building something out in overseas, the Middle East, the pipes aren't all that great. So you have to be aware of where your solutions are going to be deployed, because if the servers are here in Vegas and you're in Dubai and you didn't pay for the really expensive pipe, you know, it's just going to come trickling in and it's going to be a poor experience. Whether the encryption requirements are important, this is going to kind of go back to the HIPAA button, right? Where does the data need to be encrypted? Does it need to be encrypted at rest? Does it just need to be encrypted at transit? What are those requirements? Are you going to use HTTPS? Everybody should be using HTTPS, even if it's internal. Central administration should be over HTTPS. I mean, we've got little red warning signs that pop up all the time. Hey, this is in clear text. You're using your farm password, using all these passwords that you don't want anybody to use, but here you are, HTTP. How many people of central administration HTTPS? Wow, I thought I'd get more hands than that just because of what I just said. But oh, I gotcha. Go back and make your central administration HTTPS. And it's not that difficult. You know, that's a great question, and I will find the answer for you on that. I'll go ping a buddy after. I typically just do all mine Kerberos, but that's because they're all I'm already doing Kerberos. So I will find that answer, and I will let you know. His question was on central administration, should it be NTLM or Kerberos? My natural script, though, actually puts it in as NTLM, and I go back and address that. Blade distribution. This is a big one. I have an image later because it comes down to that same conversation of RAM and all of that. The people that do have multiple servers, a lot of times they're on the same blade. So there they are, they trip over a wire, and their high available farm just goes crashing down because it's all on the same blade. So a lot of people fail to ask that. It's not something that's just obvious, right? You're like, oh, yeah. I know how to build this. I know how to build that. But it's where are these VMs going to sit on the back end, and are they separated? Development and staging, are you going to have them? Some people say yes. Some people say no. Some people like to do their development in production. You know, whatever floats your boat, but they do have to know that there's additional risk involved there. And a lot of times, you know, you can have a development environment and it may not cost you any more money, depending on your partner status and things like that. And you can kind of, you know, haggle your way through a lot of that. Software development life cycles, that's important to kind of understand. Code out there has kind of gotten better with the forcing of using WSPs. Back in 2007, right, people were just coding straight against SharePoint and deploying those DLLs manually and stuff like that. But custom code is still a problem because, A, it doesn't port to the cloud, and you never really kind of know what people are doing. They gave us the app model, but, you know, it may not be the solution for you. External SharePoint apps, right? Are you going to use them? Are you going to have the store? How all of this is going to be configured? What are your policies going to be around that? Those are all important conversations because people haven't really seen a lot of that in action. And then the time allocated for performance and reliability testing. That is not a small number. I mean, if you're building a Visual Studio test rig to go and hit it with 500 or 5,000 concurrent users, it takes a little time to set up. So they need to kind of understand that. And if it's if they have 12 people in their organization, it's probably not a big deal. But if, you know, they have 500 people and they need SharePoint to be reliable, then, you know, investing that 20, 40 hours or whatever it might take is definitely going to be well served for them. All right, so we're going to get into a demo on asking questions, right? Let me see if my power save kicked on. We'll see if it comes up here. Hit the magic button. All right, so the document that I have prepared is available. Should be able to download with the slide deck. I'm just going to show you the format of it. So it's got basically the same questions and stuff that we've gone through, but they're in a little bit more detail. And this is the same document that I actually use while I'm at the client site. So I've got links and stuff to it so I can show them the minimum requirements. But then I'll go through, I'll print this out, and then I write down the answers to each one of those questions. That way I have all of this information. And I started doing this when I was working for one of my Microsoft certifications, because for the MCA, it was more on the soft skills of life. And that's when I really started thinking about, I don't have a lot of, for the getting ready for that board, I was like, I don't have a lot of this information. I should have captured a lot of this information. And then that's when I started coming back to this process. But then we just kind of go, you'll be able to work through the document and stuff, and it works great for you, then great. If feel free to add more to it. If you add more questions, you find that I missed some, shoot me an email or whatever. So the big thing that's important, right, we have our software requirements. This is something that before, if you're a consultant and you're going to sit down and talk to somebody, I recommend that you kind of read this like the day before. Keep it fresh in your mind. A, you know, 2013 is always being tested. We just had a new service pack come out. It'll come back out again. And, you know, it might change some of the performance pieces. But then the big one is the software boundaries and limits. And this was one of the biggest risks of of the projects. And one of the ones I'm just going to point out is on the number of app pools. So how many people have heard of Least Privileges SharePoint? Right? We've all heard of it. Just out of curiosity, how many people have a different account for every service application in their farm? A couple. So do you know what happens when we do that? So what happens is we end up creating a different app pool for every single service, right? Most of us have 10, 15 services running. We might have 3 or 4 web applications running. So if you do a quick little math, that's more than 10 app pools on any particular server. So one of the software boundaries that we have that we'll see here at the very bottom, application pools, 10 per web server. So in that situation, you either have to add a lot more RAM to be supported, or then you have to have additional servers to offload those apps so that you're still under those 10 web apps. So those are the kind of things that when you're reading the software and boundaries that might start dictating your architectures based off some of the questions that you're asking. And that's the one I like to pick on a lot because that's probably the biggest one that I see people that don't know or they forget. But as soon as you start doing that with other service applications, that's the first guy that's going to get hit. And SharePoint starts operating slower. So to get around that, what I often do is I have a service application account, a managed account, for all of my services unless that particular service requires granular permissions. TechNet will tell you to do that with Secure Store or something similar to that. How you do all of that is, you know, it's not right or wrong how you do it. You just have to make sure that you fit within the boundaries and the limits. All right. Now, here's an example of, this is Microsoft Office Division's actual SharePoint implementation on what it looks like. So you'll see that the workload that they have, 15,000 users, 2,500 unique users per hour, fairly large organization. And this is really kind of how it's mapped out. I've seen organizations much smaller than Microsoft have a lot more servers than this, just because they think they need to. But some of the things that are going to be important to know, at least in your mind, as you're building out your farms, is where's the distributed cache going to be? Where are your Office web apps going to be? How many workflow servers are you going to have? How do those fit into the requirements? And do you know all the rules around those? So that's where the technical pieces of asking the questions come from. So this is just my point to remind me to say, you know, if you are going for a high available disaster recovery scenario, you need to be using multiple blades, right? Because if everything is on one stack, it comes unplugged, with that little power thing right there, you lose everything. So the network, the power, and SharePoint server should all be distributed to where at least it's in a safe environment. So every Microsoft SharePoint 2013 implementation is different, so it's vital that we understand the requirements that will help us build a system that will promote success. So I encourage you to download the document, read it, give me a review on it. Either way, if you can't find it, let me know. But other than that, I want to thank you guys for coming to spend your morning with me.